The Republic of Pirates by Colin Woodard, continued. Disc 5.
Back in the Bahamas, Benjamin Hornigold and Henry Jennings were getting off to a bad start. There may have been bad blood from their privateering days in Jamaica, or Jennings, an educated ship captain with a comfortable estate, may have looked down on Hornigold, who was likely a penniless sailor. Jennings apparently felt that only those who had one of Lord Hamilton's privateering commissions should be attacking the Spaniards. Otherwise, you would be participating in little better than piracy. Shortly after arriving in Nassau, Jennings relieved Hornigold of one of his prizes, a small Spanish trading sloop. Having nearly 200 well-armed men and at least 2 sloops under his command, there was little Hornigold could do to stop him. Some of Jennings's men moved aboard the prize vessel, relieving the crowding on the other sloops. After a few days of revelry and the orderly distribution of the crew's portion of the prize money, the flotilla left for Jamaica. They were privateers, after all, and had to condemn their prizes at the Vice Admiralty Court, an office presided over by none other than Governor Hamilton himself. They would be back sooner than they thought. On their way to Jamaica, Jennings's flotilla was recognized by Cuban mariners. The Spaniards followed Jennings all the way down Cuba's shore, through the Windward Passage, and right to the mouth of Port Royal Harbor. Governor Torres y Ayala would hear of this, and when he did, he was going to be furious. The Barshiva dropped anchor in Jamaica on January 26, 1716. Thatch, Jennings, and Wills had only been away for about 2 months. But in that time, Lord Hamilton's situation had changed drastically. Around New Year's, word had reached the colonies that a terrible, hellish plot and conspiracy against King George had been put down back in Britain. The Tower, Exchequer, and Bank of England were all to be seized, the Boston newsletter breathlessly reported. The city of London to be set fire in many places, and insurrections to have been in several places of England. James Stuart was to invade with an army from France, all on the 25th of September last. The main Jacobite army had risen up in Scotland, with 2,000 rebels commanded by Lord Hamilton's brother, Lieutenant General Benjamin Hamilton, but they had lost the initiative to the king's forces. Simultaneous risings had been planned in Wales and Devonshire, but the authorities had gotten wind of them and arrested the plotters. By late January, the news from Britain was bad for Hamilton. The uprising was clearly failing, and the king had placed a 10,000-pound reward on the head of his brother, George Hamilton. The governor knew the time had come to start covering his tracks. Jennings and Wills brought their treasure to Hamilton in accordance with their commissions. They may not have volunteered that they had seized the treasure from the salvage camp, as opposed to the wrecks themselves, but they didn't really need to. There was simply far too much money for the privateers to have salvaged in so brief a time. Still, it was in nobody's interest to ask. Hamilton later alleged that he didn't take the shares of the treasure that were due him. For that I heard it was taken from the shore. He didn't arrest Jennings and his colleagues either. They went about free and at liberty, enjoying the pleasures of the land and spending their ill-gotten gains, as did the crews of several other privateers Hamilton had commissioned. At the end of February, when Jennings approached the governor about obtaining permission to depart on another cruise, Hamilton personally signed his departure papers. As he awaited further news of the rebellion, Hamilton kept his privateers at arm's length, neither stopping them nor arresting them. In early March, Jennings sent word to his men and fellow captains that he was making another cruise to the Spanish wrecks. Several responded, happy for a chance to get some treasure of their own. One was Lee Ashworth, who had assumed the command of one of Hamilton's other privateers, the 50-ton sloop of war, Mary. 2 others joined without commission. Samuel Little of the Coconut and James Carnegie of the Discovery, placing their small sloops under Jennings's overall command. Charles Vane, rough and mean, eagerly rejoined Jennings's crew. The sloops left Bluefields on the morning of March 9th, racing out of the harbor and away from Jamaica. That night the four vessels were separated by the wind, but a day or two later they regrouped at Isla de los Pinos, an uninhabited little island nestled behind Cuba's easternmost point. The Island of Pines later served as the model for Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island. Their plan was to sail around the far end of Cuba, follow the Gulf Stream straight to the wrecks, and loot whatever was found. They rounded Cape Corrientes on April 2nd, and on the 3rd were beating their way along Cuba's northeastern coast when the lookout on the Barsheba cried out. A few miles to the west, Sam Bellamy saw the unidentified sloop fall off the wind, bearing down toward him, followed by four consorts. He and Palsgrave Williams didn't like the look of her. Bellamy and Williams, deeply tanned, their hair bleached from months under the tropical sun, had likely arrived at the Spanish wrecks in January, shortly after Jennings's men had raided Palmar de Ais. The work was hard, dangerous, and competitive. By the end of the month, there were seven or eight other English vessels anchored where the Regla and San Roman had gone down. But try as they might, none of them were able to locate the main hull sections of the great ships. Instead, they had to content themselves with scattered cargo and coins. After weeks of work, the wreckers had scrounged up only 5,000 to 6,000 pieces of eight, 1,250 to 1,500 pounds, to share between hundreds of men. When Captain Ayala Escobar arrived from Havana with reinforcements on January 22nd and dispersed the Englishmen, Bellamy and Williams were probably just as happy to have been driven off. They made their way south, past the tip of Florida and the western end of Cuba, and down to the shores of Central America to the Bay of Honduras. They probably came to recruit men. The area was then a rough no-man's land inhabited by Mosquito Indians and gangs of rough and wild English loggers called Baymen. The latter lived in huts in the steaming swamps of what are now Belize and the Yucatan and Campeche in Mexico. They were in desperate shape, their food supplies having run short during the previous fall, causing the death by starvation of several loggers at their main camp in Campeche. At least 200 others decided to turn pirate, building great sailing canoes and heading out on the dangerous passage to New Providence or the Spanish wrecks at Palmar de Ais. In February 1716, the Spanish attacked Campeche, capturing and killing many of the remaining loggers and dispersing the rest. By the time Bellamy and Williams reached the Bay of Honduras a few weeks later, most everyone in the logging camps was looking for a way out. The two had little trouble finding men willing to become pirates. By late March, Bellamy and Williams were heading a pirate band operating out of a pair of periaguas, the very same type of sailing canoe that Hornigold and Thatch had started with 2 years earlier. Somewhere in the Bay of Honduras, they boarded their first known prize, a Dutch vessel commanded by a John Cornelissen. The band looted the vessel and forced the sailor to join them on pain of death, and shortly thereafter seized control of an English sloop under a Captain Young. While their band of wreckers and baymen searched the sloop for valuables, Bellamy and Williams tied their periaguas astern and forced Young to take them back over to Cuba. Unlike Hornigold and Jennings, they had no illusions about being privateers. They were pirates, pure and simple, and Bellamy had little sympathy for the shipowners and captains who had made his life so miserable. He argued that the band should act as Robin Hood's men, taking from the wealthy merchants and enriching the poor sailors. Williams, a wealthy merchant himself, was likely to have been motivated by sympathy for the Scots and their deposed Stuart King, or simply by the money. When off the coast of Cuba, Jennings's four sloops began bearing down on them. Bellamy and Williams saw their British colors and, fearing capture, decided to make a run for it. They ordered their men, who numbered around 40, to get all the valuables in the periaguas and prepare to abandon ship. As Jennings's Barsheba came up alongside, Bellamy's gang jumped into the sailing canoes, cast off the lines, and began rowing as hard as they could straight into the wind. From the deck of the Barsheba, Jennings watched the periaguas cast off. He could see there was little point in pursuing them. Tacking against the wind, his sloops wouldn't be able to catch them before they made it inside the reefs protecting the Cuban shore. Instead, he came alongside the sloop and hailed its master, Captain Young. Young, expecting rescue, explained that the people in the two periaguas were a parcel of villains and had just made off with all his money. Young assumed that Governor Hamilton's privateers were there to fight pirates and protect merchants like him. He was soon disappointed. Jennings was in no hurry to let Captain Young go. He put some of his men aboard and signaled to his consorts. The fleet would make its way to nearby Bahia Honda, a sheltered anchorage on a sparsely settled stretch of the Cuban coast. There they would decide what to do with Captain Young and his sloop. Upon anchoring outside the narrow entrance of the anchorage a few hours later, Jennings and his men were greeted with a wonderful surprise. Lying in the keyhole-shaped harbor was a large armed merchant ship flying French colors, much of her crew on shore collecting water and firewood. With Jennings's fleet at the harbor entrance, there could be no escape. The wind was blowing off the land, however, and even in their nimble sloops, it would be impossible for Jennings's fleet to tack into the narrow entrance. He gave orders for the five sloops to drop anchor while he tried to devise a plan. Examining the ship through his eyeglass, Jennings could see it would be suicide to undertake a direct attack. Stealth, it seemed, was the best approach. He sent three of his men in a dory to assess the situation. They rowed into the harbor and up to the French ship and hailed the captain pleasantly. They were coming into the harbor to collect water, they told him. The French captain invited them on board, and while engaging in small talk, the Englishman had a look around. They were aboard the frigate-rigged ship Sainte-Marie of Rochelle under Captain Descoubet, a wealthy man who owned a quarter of the ship and cargo. The pirates guessed there were 45 men aboard and 14 to 16 guns, though the ship was capable of carrying twice that. The Sainte Marie would make an excellent prize. When the dory returned with this news, Jennings called a meeting of the captains. He declared his desire to ambush the Sainte Marie, label her a pirate, and take her back to Jamaica as a prize. Samuel Little, captain of the Coconut, argued this would be a terrible mistake. He told the other three captains that he'd seen the Sainte Marie in Veracruz, Mexico, some months before, and that she was clearly a traitor on a lawful occasion. The other men were not convinced by Little's argument. "What are you come out for?" one of them barked at him. "To look upon one another and return with your fingers in your mouth?" Jennings chimed in that he would be aboard the French ship that very night, but that his Barsheba must not go only to be taken. If he went alongside the larger Sainte Marie, we would probably be sunk, he declared. They would need to surprise the French ship and board her from their boats. Captains Ashworth and Carnegie agreed. Little made a last-ditch effort to save the situation. The Coconut's owners had sent him to dive the Spanish wrecks, not to engage in out-and-out piracy. Unless the Sainte Marie could be shown to be a pirate or to be carrying English goods illegally, the privateers had no grounds to seize her. He implored his colleagues to delay the attack until morning, offering to personally board the Sainte Marie to see if they could make a lawful prize of her. Little found himself outvoted and made it clear he would have no part in this act of piracy. Little's men watched enviously as the crews of the Barsheba and Mary gathered arms and prepared the boats for an assault. Finally, his quartermaster announced he was joining them, abandoning Little with upward of a dozen men. It was going to be a risky venture, rowing 2 miles across the bay to engage a heavily armed ship from small boats. At sunset, something happened that changed the odds entirely. As Bellamy and Williams escaped into the wind, they watched the English privateers board Captain Young's sloop for the inevitable consultation between captains. What happened next puzzled them. Young was clearly a legitimate trader, but instead of letting him go, the privateers put a prize crew aboard and took her along with them. Hidden amid the reefs and mangroves, they watched the little flotilla anchor at the entrance to Bahia Honda. The men in the periaguas began to realize that the men operating these sloops were not acting like sheriffs at all. Around 7 p.m., as the tropical sun set over the mellowing horizon, they rowed past Carnegie's and Young's sloops and among the Barsheba, Mary, and Coconut. Bellamy and Williams, who were aboard the same sailing canoe, hailed the captain of the Barsheba. Jennings, Vane, Bellamy, and Williams all laid eyes on one another for the first time. They needed each other, they realized, to capture this great French prize. A little before 10 o'clock, the Barsheba and Mary hauled up their anchors as their officers led a cheer, all for one and one for all. The men let out a hurrah, and somebody foolishly fired a musket. Whoever did that should be cut down, some of the men said, not wishing to place the Sainte Marie on alert. Then, amidst the flickering light of the sloop's lanterns, the privateers saw a most unusual thing. Bellamy's and Williams's great canoes rowed among the sloops, their crews stripped naked, pistols and cutlasses in their hands like a pack of savages. The Barsheba's men threw a bowline out to one of the periaguas. The crew of the Mary tossed theirs to the other. Bellamy's and Williams's canoes proceeded across the bay, their men straining at their oars, each canoe towing a sloop of war, packed with heavily armed men. They must have made a terrible sight to Captain Descoubet and the bewildered men aboard the Sainte Marie. 2 Indian-style war canoes filled with naked, wild-looking men tearing across the water, the sloops of war in tow. Descoubet had been suspicious of the English sloops from the start, and had even hidden a chest of treasure ashore for fear they might attack. Even so, he was unprepared. As the periaguas closed in, Bellamy's men let go of the sloops and charged directly at his ship. "Where are you going?" one of Descoubet's men yelled at the men in the canoes. "Aboard, where do you think?" came the reply, followed by a fusillade of musket shot. A blast of fire let loose from the Barsheba, and a cannonball tore over Descoubet's head. He was outnumbered by at least 6-1. Descoubet ordered a number of his men aboard his dory, which then tried to make it ashore. One periagua overtook and captured them, while the men from the other charged onto her decks. From the second periagua, Bellamy warned the Frenchmen that if they resisted, they would all be slaughtered. Descoubet surrendered. His men hadn't fired a single musket. For Sam Bellamy, it was a lesson in the value of terror. They had taken a well-armed but lightly manned frigate without harming the crew, ships, or cargo. They'd gone into battle looking like they were capable of anything, and as a result, they hadn't had to do anything at all. For Bellamy, it was a lesson on how to conduct piracy, that fear can be the most powerful of weapons. As the Barsheba and Mary came to anchor alongside their prize, Jennings's men joined in the search of the Sainte Marie's holds and the interrogation of her men. Charles Vane, hot-headed and violence-prone, may have shaken hands and shared rum with Bellamy and Williams. This was not the sort of fellow Bellamy and Williams needed in their crew. They intended to fight smart, harm few, and score big. The next morning, April 4th, 1716, Jennings began questioning the French crew. Descoubet later reported that the English tormented the crew to such an inhumane degree, and in the vilest manner, forcing them to reveal where they had hid 30,000 pieces of eight, 7,500 pounds, ashore. Jennings also kept the Sainte Marie, appointing Carnegie as her master, and giving Descoubet and his men Carnegie's wayward Discovery instead. The pirates had captured a ship, treasure, and cargo worth 700,000 French livres, or 30,300 pounds. Jennings also forced the French captain to write a letter to Lord Hamilton in Jamaica, absolving the privateers of any wrongdoing. "I must acquaint your excellency that those gentlemen treated me very civilly and were very willing to give me so much per month for the hire or freight of my vessel," Descoubet wrote. "The privateers only took my vessel because she was fit for the expedition they were going on." While the pirates and privateers busied themselves with dividing the plunder and transferring cargo and personnel from one ship to another, a large sailing canoe arrived in Bahia Honda. Its crew innocently made their way up to the Sainte Marie, asking for Captain Descoubet. On board were a French merchant officer and 18 men who had been sent from Mariel, 20 miles farther up the coast, where their vessel, the sloop Marianne, lay at anchor. They had come to trade with Descoubet, but found themselves prisoners of the English instead. Jennings inflicted punishments on his new captives, who, after several torments, agreed to lead them back to their vessel. Jennings held a conference with Bellamy and Williams, who agreed to send one of their canoes to Mariel with the Discovery to capture this second French vessel. The following morning, Bellamy's two periagua crews split up. One headed to Mariel with Carnegie. Bellamy and Williams stayed behind with the other to make sure their newfound colleagues didn't try to cheat them out of their share of the plunder on the Sainte Marie. A few hours later, the Coconut weighed anchor and headed out in the opposite direction. Little wanted nothing to do with these piracies and was headed back to Jamaica, minus 23 members of his crew. Jennings and his men waited in Bahia Honda, hoping their colleagues would soon return with another prize. A day and night passed, and in the morning light a pair of sloops was seen passing by the harbor entrance. One, the prisoners from Mariel confirmed, was their vessel, the Marianne. The other, an armed sloop of 10 guns, flew a black flag. Jennings in vain recognized it immediately. It was the great sloop of Captain Benjamin Hornigold. Hornigold had stayed at New Providence for 2 months after Jennings's departure, no doubt seething at the shoddy treatment he'd received at the privateer's hands and hoping to even the score. Meanwhile, the outlaw population of Nassau was increasing by the day. Some 50 men had abandoned the sloops working on the nearby Spanish wrecks, most of them after waves of Spanish reinforcements arrived in February and early March. These men, resident John Vickers would later report, were committing great disorders, plundering the inhabitants, burning their houses, and ravishing their wives. The wreckers were led by Thomas Barrow, formerly a mate on a Jamaican brigantine who had run off with a cache of valuables, said to have belonged to a Spanish marquis. Barrow had no vessel of his own, but swaggered about the island claiming to be governor of Providence, and promising to make it a second Madagascar. Dozens of logwood cutters arrived every week from Campeche, attracted by inflated tales of Spanish treasure, turning to piracy upon their arrival. Others came from New England, South Carolina, and Jamaica, unemployed seamen, indentured servants, criminals on the run, even a few escaped slaves from Cuba, Hispaniola, and beyond. Ordinary settlers grew increasingly fearful, and many of them were quietly making plans to leave. Others, prostitutes, smugglers, and arms dealers, were pouring in. New Providence had turned into an outlaw state. Hornigold had started the Bahamas' burgeoning pirate republic, but between Barrow's wreckers and Hamilton's privateers, he must have felt his leadership of the flying gang was starting to slip. After all, unlike the privateers, his 200 crewmen didn't serve under legally sanctioned contracts that gave most of the plunder to the owners and captains. Apart from a few forced men, service aboard the pirate vessels was essentially voluntary. Most of the island's pirates were mariners who long suffered abuse and exploitation in the Navy and Merchant Marine. They had no intention of replicating that system, but rather turning it on its head. They took to electing their captains, and if dissatisfied with their selections, could vote to impeach them as well. The flying gang pirates gave their captains absolute authority while in combat, but most other decisions were made democratically in a general council of the crew, including where to go, what to attack, which prisoners to retain or set free, and how to punish transgressions within their companies. Hornigold and other pirate captains ate the same food as their men and had to share their cabins. The crew kept their authority further in check by electing another official, the quartermaster, who ensured that food, plunder, and assignments were doled out equitably. Captains typically received only 50% more plunder than an ordinary sailor, as opposed to perhaps 1,400% more on a privateer. If the men trusted their leader and were satisfied with his performance, they would follow him to the bitter end. If not, they might depose him in the blink of an eye. Hornigold needed to show results, or his tenure as a pirate leader might soon be over. With Thatch aboard, he set course for the sparsely settled coast of northeastern Cuba, which straddled the shipping lanes connecting Havana and the Spanish Main, New Orleans, and France. Along those poorly patrolled shores, prizes were waiting. Hornigold made his way through the Straits of Florida, probably giving Havana a wide berth, and made landfall on Cuba around April 8th, near the secluded harbor of Mariel. Sitting at anchor was a large merchant sloop flying French colors. This was the Marianne of Santo Domingo, en route from Hispaniola to the swampy French hamlet of New Orleans, under the command of a French naval officer, Ensign Le Gardieu. He had stopped to send a packet of mail to Havana, and while there, Le Gardieu heard that his colleague, Captain Descoubet of the Sainte Marie, was just down the shore. Eager to trade provisions and advice, Le Gardieu sent half his men down to Bahia Honda in the ship's boat. Undercrewed and lightly armed, she was no match for the Benjamin with her 10 guns and 200 men. Le Gardieu promptly surrendered, and Hornigold took possession of the sloop and 12,500 pounds in cargo. A prize crew was put aboard, and the two sloops made their way down the coast, perhaps hoping to take the Sainte Marie as well. At the entrance of Bahia Honda, a flotilla of English privateers had beaten them to the punch. Hornigold could see that one of them was that thorn in his side, Henry Jennings. When Jennings gave the order for all vessels to weigh anchor and chase after Hornigold, Bellamy and Williams were aboard the Sainte Marie, their periagua tied astern. They helped the prize crew raise the French ship's anchors and watched as the Bathsheba and Mary raced off. By the time the Sainte Marie was underway, the rest of the fleet had already passed out of sight. Opportunity, the two men could see, had come knocking. As the Sainte Marie pulled out of the harbor, Bellamy and Williams gave the signal. Their men rose up in unison, surprising Jennings's prize crew and the French prisoners, and seized control of the ship. While some of Bellamy's men held their captives at gunpoint, the others quickly hauled their periagua alongside and threw sacks and chests of coins aboard. Keeping an eye on the Barsheba and Mary, 6 or 8 miles off, Bellamy and Williams got their men aboard the canoe as well and rowed off into the wind. Their take? 28,500 pieces of eight, 7,125 pounds. To put it in perspective, the annual income of an early 18th century merchant captain was about 65 pounds. Meanwhile, Jennings, Vane, and the other men aboard the Barsheba knew they were never going to catch up to Hornigold and the Marianne. They could also see that the Sainte Marie had fallen dangerously far behind. Better to return to Bahia Honda, Jennings noted, than lose our own prize. At his signal, the Barsheba and Mary swung around. An hour or two later, they approached the Sainte Marie. Her crew hailed them, clearly distraught. Bellamy's men had risen against them and made off with everything, they said. Murmurs of discontent spread through the Barsheba. Jennings had lost much of their plunder. The furious privateer ordered his men to seize the other periagua, and as the Mary's carpenter, Joseph Eales, later recalled, had it cut to pieces, apparently along with any of Bellamy's men who were aboard it at the time. During this rage, Jennings also ordered the hapless Captain Young's sloop burnt to the waterline. Sometime later, his anger spent, Jennings gave out new orders. The fleet would sail for Nassau to divide up what remained of their spoils. After the heist, Bellamy and Williams caught up with Hornigold. The pirates met face to face off the coast of Cuba. Hornigold must have been pleased to learn that the men in the canoes had managed to steal Jennings's treasure from right under his nose. He could use men like these. Bellamy and Williams, after the pirate articles were read, joined the crew of the Benjamin. Mariners appreciate competence, and Bellamy must have inspired a great deal of it, for despite his youth, Hornigold appointed Bellamy as the captain of the newly captured Marianne, ahead of several older men in his own crew, including Edward Thatch and his quartermaster, William Howard. Bellamy presumably manned the Marianne with his periagua crew of 20 or 30, plus some 30 to 40 of Hornigold's men. He and Williams now had a well-built ocean-going sloop at their disposal, a chest of treasure in the hold, and the most infamous English pirate of the day as their consort. All they needed were some cannon to arm their new raider. For a week or more, they continued prowling the eastern end of Cuba, waiting to intercept Spanish or French traffic coming through the Yucatan Channel. But instead of a rich prize, they came across yet another pirate. Olivier Labuse, captain of the armed sloop Postillon, joined the pirate squadron. Labuse and Hornigold made peculiar allies. Labuse and most of his crew were French, while Hornigold still saw himself as a patriot, carrying on a righteous war against England's enemies. Labuse and his men were bona fide pirates, happy to plunder anybody for a profit. Somehow, the French corsair and the English captains agreed to work together, cementing a transnational relationship that would last for many years. It's likely that Bellamy had something to do with this arrangement. The young man wasn't fighting for Britain, he was fighting against the system. Captains, shipowners, kings, the whole lot. And not a few of Hornigold's own company felt the same way. If Hornigold objected to sailing with the French pirate, his men overruled him. The Postillon, armed with 8 guns, would be sailing with them. Not long afterward, the three pirates, Hornigold, Bellamy, and Labuse, spotted a merchant ship coming across the Yucatan Channel from the direction of Campeche. This turned out to be an English ship bound for Holland with a load of logwood, a friendly vessel, not a prize. Unlike Hornigold, Labuse and Bellamy had no compunction about sacking an English ship. A vote was taken, and Hornigold's men again overruled him. While Bellamy and the unarmed Marianne held back, Labuse and Hornigold secured the prize. A crew was sent aboard to search and sail the ship. They took what odds and ends seemed useful, drink, coins, provision, spare parts, a skilled crewman or two, and after 8 or 10 days let her go on her way, probably at Hornigold's insistence. A few days later, at the eastern tip of Cuba, they made a capture everyone could be happy with. 2 Spanish brigantines, loaded with cocoa, which they captured without firing a shot. After looting the vessels, they sailed to Isla de los Pinos, where they found 3 or 4 English sloops topping off water and firewood supplies. The hulls of the pirate vessels needed cleaning, so the pirates announced to the masters of the small sloops that their vessels were to be commandeered to help with the careening process. Hornigold may have found an unpleasant surprise on the underside of the Benjamin. The shipworms appeared to have done her serious damage, something requiring the services of a proper shipyard to remedy. Hornigold began contemplating the disposal of his great sloop, the possession of which had caused so much alarm among the law-abiding citizenry of New Providence. The careening completed, the pirates continued along the southern shore of Cuba, bound for the Windward Passage. Labuse knew of some good hideouts along the shores of sparsely populated French Hispaniola, and directed the fleet in that direction. Hispaniola was well placed for raiding commerce coming in and out of the Caribbean. A lair was found and agreed on, and the pirates resolved to work together to sack as many vessels as possible. Hornigold wanted to get rid of the Benjamin first, and sometime around the end of May 1716, resolved to sail to Nassau for that purpose. The Benjamin was loaded up with bulky cargoes to sell to the Bahamas' growing cadre of unscrupulous smugglers. Bellamy and Williams may have come along as well, in the interest of securing cannon for the Marianne. Hornigold, Thatch, and at least 150 others left Labuse, agreeing to return in a few weeks' time. On April 22, 1716, Henry Jennings's privateering fleet arrived in Nassau's expansive harbor. It was quite a sight. The Sainte Marie, now equipped with 32 guns, escorted by Jennings's own 10-gun Bathsheba and Ashworth's 10-gun Mary. It was the most powerful naval force New Providence had seen since Henry Avery had shown up with the Fancy 20 years earlier. Jennings, Ashworth, and Carnegie all went ashore to the bawdy town of Nassau, leaving their vessels in the hands of trusted subordinates. After 2 or 3 days, the quartermaster of the Sainte Marie, the sickly Alan Bernard, rode to town and interrupted Jennings's debauchery. Apart from 4 or 5 men, the entire complement of the Bathsheba was aboard the Sainte Marie looting her remaining cargo. "This must not be," Jennings is said to have exclaimed. He told Bernard to go on board and dissuade them, by claiming that none of them could afford to delay departure for the wrecks. "Between you and I," he confided, "if I can get her out to sea again with ye goods in her, I will run her up to Jamaica and secure her, for these fellows have drawn me into this mess and will doubtless, when they have shared ye goods, leave me to answer all." Bernard, suffering from a stomach ache, begged the captain to go himself, to lend the weight of his authority. With both his authority and a large quantity of valuables at stake, it would have seemed a prudent measure. But Jennings refused, telling his quartermaster he would not be concerned with such rogues. Apparently, the captain had more important things to do between the taverns and whorehouses. On his way to the shore, Bernard came across Carnegie and Ashworth and apprised them of the situation. The two captains took the situation more seriously than their commodore, each volunteering to help Bernard restore order on the Sainte Marie. Ashworth immediately rowed out to the Mary to make sure his crew hadn't joined the riot, while Carnegie and Bernard made their way to the Sainte Marie. The French ship was a scene of chaos. 100 men poured over her, hauling European goods and supplies from her holds, piling them in boats, and rowing them over to the desolate shore of Hog Island, not far from the rotting bones of Henry Avery's fancy. None of them had the slightest interest in what Carnegie and Bernard had to say. Flummoxed, Bernard returned to shore to try to raise Jennings to action. The captain was once again unmoved and told Bernard to watch over them and to not take any cargo by force. Bernard spent the rest of the day observing the men's actions on the Hog Island shore. They had divided the plunder into three lots, and contrary to the practice of privateers, had allocated two lots for themselves and one for the owners, rather than the other way around. They should have taken all the plunder back to Jamaica to be distributed and taxed by the Vice Admiralty Court. Instead, they immediately divided their lots among themselves. Only the owner's lot was to be sent to Jamaica. Not wanting to entrust the owner's share to Jennings, the crew contracted the services of a local sloop, the Dolphin. This 10-ton vessel, curiously enough, belonged to one of Thomas Walker's sons, Neil. Before the Dolphin's departure, Jennings, Ashworth, and Carnegie decided their best course of action was to inform their vessel's owners of their taking the French ship and the insubordination of the men. They drew up a manifest of the Dolphin's contents and wrote detailed letters to their owners and business partners and entrusted them with Alan Bernard and the Mary's quartermaster, Joseph Eales. Bernard and Eales boarded the Dolphin, letters in hand, and began the journey home. After the Dolphin's departure, Jennings managed to secure control of the Sainte Marie and mustered a crew for her, the Bathsheba, and the Mary to sail for the Spanish wrecks. They arrived a few days later, their considerable firepower presumably scaring off the Spanish guard ships. A passing English merchantman later reported that the Sainte Marie was presiding over a total of 24 English vessels on the wrecks, half Jamaican, half Bermudan, which would not permit either French or Spaniards to come there. According to the Bathsheba's youthful doctor, John Cochrane, divers managed to take some money out of ye water before sailing back to Nassau. Not long thereafter, Jennings, still considering himself an honorable privateer, led the Bathsheba and Sainte Marie back to Jamaica. It's likely that Charles Vane did not return to Jamaica with the Bathsheba. Nothing was there for him except the possibility of legal proceedings. On the other hand, on New Providence, he had his share of treasure, a good harbor at his disposal, and a town filled with brothers in arms. Given his personality, Vane was likely a ringleader of the looting of the Sainte Marie, in which case the owners would not have been pleased with him. It was better to stay in Nassau and enjoy a merry life until the money ran out. Hornigold and Thatch sailed into Nassau in early June. They had been gone 2 months, and the pirate society on New Providence had grown in their absence. Dozens of periaguas, launches, and sloops sheltered inside Hog Island, their lines indicating a mix of origins, Spanish, French, English, and Dutch. Along the shore, the pirates had beached a couple of unwanted prize sloops, their looted hulls baking in the sun. Amid the palms, palmettos, and tropical scrub, smoke rose from the cooking fires of 100 huts, tents, and hovels. Most of these were made from whatever was handy, driftwood, old spars, decking, and worm-eaten hulls covered over with palmetto thatch or bits of old sailcloth. The ruder sort was home to groups of logwood cutters driven from Campeche or black and Indian slaves on the run from their masters in Cuba, Hispaniola, or Jamaica. Slightly better were the hovels of the wreckers and former mariners. Nassau looked like an encampment of castaways, with sailors singing, dancing, drinking, and fornicating. Increasing numbers of wives and prostitutes were settling on the island, tending alehouses, mending clothes, cooking meals, and keeping the men company at night. One young sailor, James Bonney, had recently arrived from South Carolina with his 16-year-old wife, Anne. The latter quickly earned a reputation for libertine behavior. For most of the mariners, it was a dream come true. Ample food, drink, women, and leisure time. And when the money ran out, there was always another ship to capture, a plantation to loot, a treasure wreck to dive on. The better homes, simple frame houses, belonged to the merchant smugglers, who bought the pirates' plunder with cheap rum, tobacco, and ammunition, and to the settlement's leading figures. Once these homes had belonged to New Providence's law-abiding colonists, but most had been forced to flee the town for fear of being murdered. Thomas Barrow, the leader of the wreckers, had harassed them without mercy, shaking them down for drinking money and whipping anyone who refused him. Even the merchants who came to trade with the pirates were not necessarily safe. In the harbor, Barrow robbed a brigantine from New England and beat up the master of a Bermuda sloop. Some vessels were apparently off-limits, including the Richard and John, the 14-ton sloop owned by Hornigold and Thatch's old pirate buddy, John Cockrum, and Cockrum's influential father-in-law, Richard Thompson. Cockrum and his brothers, Joseph and Philip, were running a successful trading syndicate out of Harbor Island, shipping pirate goods to Charleston and sugar and provisions back to Nassau. They competed with Benjamin Sims, a 40-year veteran of New Providence, and Neil Walker, whose sloop Dolphin was said to be in Jamaica at that very time, bearing a load of Henry Jennings's plunder. Together, these merchant smugglers provided vital logistical support to the Bahamian pirates. The pirates themselves have often told me that if they had not been supported by the traders bringing them ammunition and provisions, according to their directions, a colonial official would report in 1718, they could never have become so formidable, nor arrived to that degree of strength that they have. While Hornigold looked for someone to sell the Benjamin to, the others bought and sold goods and personal items and exchanged news and stories with the wreckers and logwood cutters. Along the way, they learned that Jennings's own men had turned on him to loot the Sainte Marie. They ate fresh fish and pineapples and pork and chicken that had never seen the inside of a barrel, and drank Madeira wine and Barbados rum. Bellamy may have felt he'd found paradise, a republic of sailors, freed from those who would exploit them, free to live the merry life as long as the agents of empire could be kept away. Hornigold found a buyer for the Benjamin, a Virginian merchant by the name of Perrin, who also happily purchased most of his plunder. With the proceeds, the pirate commodore purchased another sloop, transferred his guns aboard, and christened her the Adventure. The Adventure was considerably smaller and less threatening than the Benjamin, probably only 20 tons or so. The trade, Thomas Walker reported, had weakened Hornigold, and in some measure had disabled him from doing such damages upon the high seas as he would have done if he had continued his command of the Benjamin. The trade made, Hornigold oversaw the fitting out of his third pirate sloop of war. He was also concerned about the future of the pirate republic. All it would take to do them in, he knew, was for the English, French, or Spanish to send 3 or 4 men of war to Nassau. But if the town could be better fortified, authority might be kept at bay. He looked at the assorted cannons poking from the sloops in the harbor, then up at the ruined shape of Fort Nassau. Yes, he realized, the time had come to arm the island, not just its vessels. He organized Thatch and others to obtain cannon, pulleys, shot, and powder, and began rearming the old fortress. For Thomas Walker, this was the final straw. For nearly a year, he, his wife, and his children had been threatened and abused by these rogues. He had begged the outside world to quash the pirates before they grew too strong, but to no avail. He knew that he would be killed if he tried to stop them from fortifying the harbor. If they succeeded, it would be far harder to root them out. He gathered his family and fled to Charleston, leaving Nassau to the pirates. Back in Jamaica, Lord Archibald Hamilton's life was going from bad to worse. With each passing week, the news from Britain grew bleaker. By mid-March, he knew that the main Jacobite army had suffered a devastating defeat near the English town of Preston, and at least 4,000 had been taken prisoner. James Stuart and his entourage had reportedly landed in Scotland, but, not finding things according to their expectation, had fled back to France 4 days later. By the end of April, Lord Hamilton found his nephew Basil's name on a list of nobles captured at Preston and imprisoned in London. The uprising had failed before the colonies had even had a chance to join in. Lord Hamilton's Jacobite activities were catching up with him. In March, Samuel Page, the secretary of Jamaica's governing council, had sailed for England carrying a sheaf of damning documents, letters, and depositions that he intended to present to King George. The Assembly of Jamaica and the former commodore of the local naval detachment were submitting evidence against him. Peter Heywood, a member of the governing council, was maneuvering to replace Hamilton as governor by professing his support of King George's sacred person and family. Hamilton's privateers were causing him further trouble. The activities of Jennings, Willis, Fernando, Ashworth, and others had generated a flurry of hostile letters from the governors of Cuba and French Hispaniola. Governor Torres y Ayala of Havana wrote that several gentlemen of Jamaica had told him that Hamilton was part owner of all the vessels which have been sent to our camp at Palmar de Ice. All the treasure had to be returned, and the perpetrators seized and punished. The Cuban governor's ambassador in Jamaica had traced some of the stolen money to Hamilton's own house. Recently, there was the matter of the Dolphin, a little Bahamian sloop that had shown up filled with goods Jennings and his gang had recently plundered from a French ship. Then came Henry Jennings himself, the Sainte Marie in tow, though minus the coins and valuables she once carried. To top it off, an official French delegation arrived bearing a letter from the governor of Hispaniola demanding the return of this ship and another French sloop, supposedly captured by Jennings. "I believe, my lord, all these actions must occasion horror," the governor had written Hamilton. "I know several of the privateers have estates in Jamaica. It is but just they should be sold, and the money employed to repair the wrong they have done. I demand it of your excellency in point of justice." The entourage included Captain Descoubet, who was extremely angry to see his ship, the Sainte Marie, anchored in Port Royal, awaiting Hamilton's condemnation. Alas, if the Jacobite uprising had succeeded, Hamilton could have used the privateers to fund his administration and secure the surrounding colonies for the rightful kings of England and Scotland. Instead, they had become a liability. They would have to be rounded up and sacrificed for the cause. He put out orders that Jennings and the other captains not be allowed to leave the island. Shortly thereafter, in late July, there was a knock at Hamilton's door. The HMS Adventure had arrived from Britain bearing orders from King George. Lord Hamilton was to be arrested and delivered to England in chains. Peter Haywood, the leader of Hamilton's opponents on the governing council, had been appointed governor, and he immediately launched a full investigation of Hamilton's privateers. Jennings's commission had been seized, and he went into hiding. A good thing, too, for in late August, another ship arrived from London bearing an official proclamation from King George. It was printed and posted around the island on August 30th and distributed across the British Americas in the weeks that followed. The king had declared Jennings, Carnegie, Ashworth, Wills, and others to be pirates. By then, Jennings and his men were already halfway to their sanctuary, beyond the reach of the law, the Bahamas. Chapter 6, Brethren of the Coast, June 1716 to March 1717. In late June or early July 1716, the pirates regrouped at their Hispaniola hideaway. Bellamy and Williams in the Marianne, Hornigold and Thatch in the newly acquired sloop Adventure, and Labuse aboard the Postillon. All should have been well. The three sloops were freshly cleaned, and there was plenty of fresh water, wine, ammunition, and powder stowed away below decks. There were nearly 200 men between them, and a safe haven from which to sally forth and strike merchantmen as they passed through the Windward Passage. But relations between the pirate companies were strained. Hornigold's rule over the little squadron was failing due to his reluctance to attack English and Dutch vessels. He thought himself a vigilante, settling old scores with the French and Spanish. Friendly vessels were boarded only as a last resort, to acquire vital supplies or skilled crewmen. Bellamy and Williams thought differently, and Labuse and his largely French crew didn't see any reason to spare English shipping. While Hornigold had been away in Nassau, Bellamy and Labuse had attacked several English vessels off the southern coast of Cuba, seizing men, provisions, and liquor. Hornigold was angry to learn of this upon returning. In the heat of August, tensions reached a breaking point. Bellamy and Labuse wished to plunder an English vessel. Hornigold again refused. Aboard the Adventure, many of Hornigold's men called for his impeachment. The Commodore was overlooking valuable prizes, and he'd lost the Benjamin to boot. Perhaps younger, more radical leadership was in order. The quartermaster likely called for a vote of the ship's company. Hornigold had lost the confidence of two-thirds of the crew. The majority was ready for no-holds-barred piracy and decided to join Bellamy and Labuse aboard their sloops. Hornigold, they decreed, could keep the Adventure, but was to leave the rendezvous immediately and not show his face there again. Humiliated, the deposed Commodore headed back toward the Bahamas with 26 loyal men, including his protege, Edward Thatch. Even for a pirate, the speed of Samuel Bellamy's ascent to power was startling. Only a year after leaving New England as a penniless sailor, he had become the commodore of a gang of 170 pirates. He and Williams had already captured prizes worth thousands of pounds, more money than he and his fellow sailors could ever have hoped to see in a lifetime of legitimate service. He was 27, and his career was just beginning. Most of the 90 men in his own sloop's crew were English and Irish, with a few Scots, Welsh, Spaniards, and Dutchmen, a Swede, and at least two men of African descent. Most were in their mid-20s or early 30s, former seamen and privateers who had willingly entered piracy. A few had been forced to serve, at least at first. John Fletcher, whom Hornigold had kidnapped off the Blackett in October 1715, had come to embrace the pirate life. The crew liked and trusted him so much that they elected him to serve as the Marianne's quartermaster. Others were unwilling captives, like Richard Caverley, seized from an English sloop on account of his navigational skills, and Peter Hoff, the 34-year-old Swede with extensive knowledge of the Southern Caribbean. Bellamy would need their expertise in the months ahead. After Hornigold's departure, Bellamy and Labuse detained several sailing canoes, dinghies, and cargo boats, which kept their galleys stocked. They seemed to have taken it easy through the end of the summer, eating, drinking, and making merry. By September, Bellamy reckoned it was time to expand their horizons. He proposed to his crew that they sail eastward, down the curving spine of the Antilles to the Spanish Main, chasing any sail crossing their path. The men agreed, as did those under Labuse. At the height of hurricane season, they began their trek from Hispaniola. They sailed against the prevailing winds, tacking their way along the mountainous shores of Hispaniola and Puerto Rico. It was a quiet trip, punctuated only by whatever marine life passed their way. A curious pod of dolphins, or a cascade of flying fish scattering fearfully before the sloop's hulls. But as they passed the far end of Puerto Rico and began the crossing to St. Thomas, a lookout spotted the telltale triple-masted outline of a ship on the horizon. As they closed the distance, Bellamy could see it was quite large, a frigate, really, flying French colors. A long row of gun ports pierced her side with a second, shorter row on her poop and forecastle. 40 guns, all told, making her a small frigate similar to the Sainte Marie, the French ship they'd looted under Jennings's nose. Unlike the Sainte Marie, however, this ship was fully armed and was not confined in a harbor anchored to the seafloor. Her sails were up and her great guns were rolling out for action. A mighty prize, to be sure. One that could allow them to attack most anything in the West Indies, but not an easy one to capture. Bellamy consulted Labuse and his men and resolved to hazard a bold strike. Bellamy and Labuse were outgunned 2-1, so they had to count on outmaneuvering their powerful opponent. Unfortunately, they weren't able to do so. The French ship delivered a broadside against the Marianne, cannonballs tearing through her decks, sending splinters in all directions. After an hour's engagement, Bellamy called off the attack. One of his men was dead, and three were seriously wounded. The French ship proceeded on her way. They spent October and November prowling the Virgin Islands, then a sparsely populated archipelago contested by four nations. 500 Danish colonists lived on St. Thomas, overseeing the labor of more than 3,000 African slaves. Several hundred English lived on Tortuga, the westernmost part of the sprawling British Leeward Islands colony, which stretched out 300 miles down the Antilles to Antigua and Nevis. The Danes and English both claimed uninhabited St. John. The French and Danes argued over St. Croix, while the Spaniards held on to several other islands. With so many rival nations squabbling over such a small area, the Virgin Islands provided ideal conditions for swift commerce raiders like Bellamy and Labuse. They could steal a merchantman and take off over the border if a warship or coast guard vessel tried to pursue them. The prizes proved small, but they kept themselves in food and drink by seizing a variety of hapless fishing vessels and a French cargo ship carrying flour and salted cod. On at least one occasion, they forced unmarried men to join them, but let the married men go free, knowing their family bonds made them much harder to mold into committed bandits. On the morning of November 9th, as the pirates cruised the wide passage between St. Thomas and St. Croix, the rising sun revealed a sloop approaching from the west. It was a still morning, the wind barely filling their sails, but it was behind them. Bellamy and Labuse were able to overtake the vessel, a merchantman flying British colors. Bellamy ordered his gunner to fire a cannon over the sloop's bow, while Labuse had a large black flag with a death's head and bones across hoisted to the top of the postillion's mast. The master of the sloop, Abijah Savage, saw there was no point in resisting. Each of the pirate sloops had 8 guns and between 80 and 90 men. Savage's vessel, the Bonetta, was unarmed and crowded with passengers traveling from Jamaica to his home island of Antigua, the capital of the British Leeward Islands. There was an excitable 9 or 10-year-old traveling with his mother, an Antiguan planter heading home in the company of his Indian slave boy, a Negro or two, and some hired hands. No match for the approaching sloops, their decks packed with armed, wild-looking men. Savage did what virtually every shipmaster did when confronted with well-organized pirates. He struck his sails, pointing his vessel into the wind, where her sails flapped uselessly like laundry hung out to dry. The universal maritime signal of submission. The Bonetta drifted to a stop, rolling gently in the swells. Savage and his men hoisted a boat over the side, climbed in, and rowed over to see what their captors wanted of them. In council, the pirates resolved to detain the Bonetta and her complement for the time being. It wouldn't be long before the sloops would need to be cleaned again, and they would need a spare vessel to careen against. Savage and his men were confined aboard the Marianne while the pirates took possession of his sloop and set course for the all-but-deserted island of St. Croix. Savage and his crew remained prisoners for 15 days, almost all of which were spent at anchor in the harbor of St. Croix. During this time, Savage later reported, Bellamy and Labuse were primarily concerned with exchanging their sloops for a combat-capable ship, which, with luck, they believed they should be able to conquer and make a voyage. While the pirates cleaned the hulls of their vessels, 3 of the forced men fled into the dense foliage surrounding the harbor. The pirates recaptured one of the escapees, the Swede Peter Hoff, whom they severely whipped for the infraction. The sloops cleaned, Bellamy informed Savage that he, his men, and cargo would be free to go. The pirates, whom one witness said pretended to be Robin Hood's men, also had a penchant for fancy dress and took the clothes of the wealthy passengers. They also seized a black slave and an Indian boy belonging to an Antiguan planter, but were prepared to let the remaining passengers and crew go. But one of Savage's passengers, the 9 or 10-year-old child, John King, begged the pirates to take him with them. When his mother tried to stop him, King threatened her with violence and, according to Savage, declared he would kill himself if he was restrained from joining Bellamy's crew. The pirates must have been amused by the little boy, dressed in silk stockings and fine leather shoes, for they took him in, aboard the Marianne. There were plenty of 10-year-old ship's boys on naval and merchant ships, and now they had 2 of their own. To Mrs. King's horror, her son took an oath of loyalty to the pirates, promising not to steal even a single piece of 8 from the company, and sailed away with his new companions. Bellamy was well aware that once Captain Savage reached Antigua, the alarm would spread across the Leeward Islands. The pirates needed to stay ahead of their former prisoners by quickly sailing down the chain toward the Spanish Main. From St. Croix, they made for Saba, a tall, jagged Dutch island 75 miles farther east, their eyes peeled for a combat-suitable ship. They didn't wait long. The very next day, with Saba looming to the northeast, they spotted and overtook an armed merchantman. The Sultana, a British ship-rigged galley with 26 guns, was a formidable vessel, but considerably smaller than the 40-gun French ship they tried to take several weeks earlier. Bellamy and Labuse raised the skull and crossbones, confident that this time they had found an opponent they could handle. Little did they know how easy the engagement would be. Sultana's captain, John Richards, was in his cabin suffering from wounds he'd received earlier in the voyage and entirely unable to organize her defense. The Marianne and Postillon quickly outmaneuvered her. The Sultana would never arrive at the Bay of Campeche to take on a cargo of logwood as planned. she would become a pirate ship instead. With the approval of the crew, Bellamy assumed command of the Sultana. The ship represented a marked increase in power. As a galley, she was constructed for speed and maneuverability, with flush decks and a sleek and narrow hull. The Sultana was not as big as Bellamy would have liked, but she made an excellent stepping stone, a tool that would win him a proper frigate. Bellamy's prestige among the crew was so great that they selected his friend and confidant, Palsgrave Williams, to assume command of the Marianne. The silversmith and the farmer's boy were now in a position to do serious damage to the merchants of the Atlantic. Within hours, the pirates captured a second ship, a clumsy merchant vessel under a Captain Tosor, who had been sailing for Campeche under the protection of the Sultana's guns. Tosor's vessel was plundered, and because the pirates were running increasingly short of manpower, several of his men were forced into service. Tosor himself was allowed to proceed on his way to Campeche in his ship. One of Bellamy's crewmen, Simon van Voorst, a 24-year-old Dutchman born in the former Dutch city of New York, later recalled seeing many of the forced men cry and express their grief at their fate. More than a few would change their minds as the treasure piled up over the coming months. The three-vessel squadron continued along the Leeward Islands, passing the British outposts on St. Christopher, Nevis, and Montserrat. Wishing to avoid entanglements with the Royal Navy, they gave Antigua a wide berth. They needn't have worried. At that time, there wasn't a single British warship between Jamaica and Barbados. On Antigua, the governor of the British Leeward Islands, Walter Hamilton, no relation to Lord Archibald Hamilton, had been apprised of the pirates' presence by the arrival of Captain Savage, but had no means to respond. At that moment, a merchant sloop was racing for Barbados with an urgent message for his counterpart there, asking that he dispatch his guardship, the HMS Scarborough, to protect English shipping from the vermin of pirates. But it was 250 miles to Barbados, and if his request was granted, Hamilton knew it would be 3 weeks before help could get to his sprawling, poorly defended colony. In the second week of December, the pirates captured a pair of trading vessels within sight of the French island of Guadeloupe, which they looted of food and other necessities. Then they turned south-southwest, letting the Lesser Antilles and their angry governors sink slowly behind the horizon. Bellamy knew it was time to find a hideaway to overhaul his new flagship and prepare for bigger things. They sailed for Spanish waters, for the remote island of La Blanquilla, where they could expect to conduct such business without disturbance.
This audiobook is continued on Disc 6.